So as Adam said, this is part one of a two-parter, and the two very much go hand in hand, because today we approach the cross, and next week we look at the resurrection, and you can't really have one without the other. I just wanted to say, with this topic, whenever I talk about something like the cross, it always, I guess, weighs on me a little bit more than a normal talk, because you really want to do it justice, you want to get it right, and of different parts of Scripture to feel like you're really getting the message tuned correctly. This is the one where I feel most sensitive to that. And so you come to it feeling a bit heavier than you might for a slightly lighter topic. And I just wanted to say that the whole of this morning, people not knowing what the topic, the theme, what I'm speaking about, the whole meeting has been such an encouragement to me, from the pictures and the words at Prayer Place to the songs chosen, and in particular, Scott, to the word you just bought. You can all think of this as Scott's word part two, as what he brought was so beautifully on the nose, and that's so encouraging when you're about to bring something. And then before we really get into it, I just want to say at the start, to cover off all plagiarism, I'm drawing particularly on Tom Wright this morning, his book, The Day the Revolution Began. I tried referencing and quoting, but it just got a bit much. Caveat at the start, and we'll move on. Anyway, so we've been reading John as a church. We've been going through a series on John, exploring it together. And one thing has really struck me as I've been thinking it through this term. One thing's really stuck in my brain. And that's how incredibly young John was at the time that the stories took place. He could have been as young as 15, maybe a little older. But imagine spending your latter teenage years with Jesus. I'm fairly confident. I've racked my brains. I think John probably had the greatest teenage years in history. I think he probably saw more as a teenager than anybody else that would blow your mind. So it's no wonder that he then spent the next 60 years or more of his life chewing everything he saw over, processing it, making sense of it. Because he probably wrote John in his late 70s or 80s, having had all that time to think it through. And so as I've been reading the book, I've kind of had these two versions of John, the teenager, and then the dark, leather-faced old man who came to write the book with these sort of inch-deep wrinkles and a white beard. And I imagine in my head that John would have had these sort of big crow's feet around his eyes from a lifetime smiling because of time spent with Jesus. I imagine as he's writing the Gospel of John that his eyes are lighting up as he's got this huge sheet of papyrus and a big stick of pen, whatever they used. And I just imagine him sort of loving every minute of it. And the person who came to mind as I thought of John was, for those of you who knew him, you'll understand why, our dearly beloved Peter Kingston. Because he loved to tell the wildest stories. People are laughing because they remember. His arms would sort of accordion as he got going, and his animation would intensify. And it was really beautiful to see. There's nothing better than an old man telling his best stories, is there? And I think you knew he'd reached a point in his life where he'd decided he'd perfected the telling of his favorite stories. And you knew that because he told them to you word for word the exact same way every time. And I imagine that John had done the same thing with the stories that he told about Jesus. So we're just going to take a moment to think of some of them. We've explored them already. So John, remember, he's 15. He's at a wedding, a town called Cana. And he witnesses a man who he doesn't really know at this point turn water into, I did the maths, what roughly translates into 882 bottles of very good wine. I expect all the people in the room at that wedding who didn't go on to write gospels of their own were still telling that particular story for the rest of their lives. And then there's another one. I just imagine John, still a young man, he's standing near Jesus in a crowded room, and then pieces of ceiling plaster start to fall to the floor. And then this paralyzed man is lowered on ropes through a hole in the ceiling with his cheeky friends peering in, looking delighted. And then the thing that of all things Jesus does is he forgives this man's sins. Entirely unexpected. And then, even more unusual, the paralyzed man stands up, rolls up his mat, and walks away. I wonder, John being the youngest, if he's the one given the broomstick, told to sweep up. What's John thinking as he sweeps up the ceiling plaster, given what he's just seen? For John, Lazarus wasn't just a name. He was one of Jesus's close friends. So we know that he was someone John would have come to know dearly over the years he spent with Jesus. Maybe he's a bit older by this point. But then, of course, Lazarus dies. And so John, like everyone there, would have been heartbroken. And so through tears and sobbing, John may then have heard the words Jesus spoke, where he said, "Lazarus, come out." And then the man walks out his tomb, still stinking, still bound in linen, but alive. And I just find myself thinking, how does it change the course of the rest of your life if as a teenager you witness things like that? You know how formative your teenage years can be. And then you compare John's gospel, in my mind, with the other three gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And they are, I think you call them much more strictly, biographies of the life of Jesus. They're focused on telling the story sort of in a research way. Whereas I would say John, to me, having read it, it feels more like a memoir of John's time spent with Jesus. It's a much more intimate account of what took place across those incredible 3 years of Jesus' ministry. And I think this sense of intimacy reaches its climax with John's telling of what takes place at the climax of the cross of the story. And this is on a small rocky knoll. You can imagine it as you look at our cross here, atop a disused limestone quarry beside a main road just outside the walls of Jerusalem. And it's here, at the foot of the cross, that John weaves a really profound theological account with a very deeply private memory of what took place at Golgotha. And I say that because I want you to think again of that young man, that teenager. He's now maybe 18, still young in the grand scheme of things. He's seen miracle after miracle for 3 years straight. He is astounded time and again by the love of Jesus. Nothing else shines through more clearly in the Gospel of John than the love of Jesus. He's seen that everywhere his troop goes, ordinary people adore Jesus. You can see that John really loves him. It really comes through in his telling of Jesus's life. But then this poor boy watches for hours. And there's no easy way to say it, but as Jesus dies in the most awful and shameful and painful way. And you can see it in how it's written, I think, that for John, these are hard memories. Even with what comes later, mostly saved for next week, these are still hard memories for him to recount. Because the story slows down, it turns inward, and it almost trembles as you read it in places. And so we will just briefly read it together. No need to get it up in your own Bible, as I've kind of trimmed it a little bit. But it goes like this. Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and they put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and they went up to him again and again saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they slapped him in the face. And the soldiers took charge of Jesus, carrying his own cross. He went out to the place of the skull, Golgotha. And there they crucified him with two others, one on each side with Jesus in the middle. Near the cross of Jesus stood his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, Mary Magdalene. And when Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved, it's John, standing nearby, he said to her, "Woman, here's your son." And to the disciple, "Here's your mother." And from that time on, this disciple took her into his home. Later, knowing everything had now been finished and that scripture would be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I am thirsty." A jar of wine vinegar was there, so they soaked a sponge in it and put the sponge on a stalk of the hyssop plant and lifted it to Jesus' lips. When he received the drink, Jesus said, "It is finished." With that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. To the Romans, you can probably tell in that story, crucifixion was about erasing someone's identity. It was about removing their name, their history, their story, the idea being that it ends on the cross. And so Jesus dies in agony. He dies naked. He dies shamed and erased. And yet John says, "This is glory." Everything I've just said, this is glory. He says it across the whole gospel. I won't draw them all out now. It makes no sense. And yet John's certain of it. And this is the question, or one of, that I think he spent 60 years wrestling with to answer. And the book he's written is that answer, the Gospel of John. And he opens it with a signal as to how we can come to the same conclusion he did in the beginning. He starts with the words, "in the beginning," reminding us of the book of Genesis, when the world was created. All throughout his memoir, he has been weaving in the story of creation at different moments, and the fall, and of the garden of Adam and Eve, and all the breadcrumbs are there for us to follow. And so let's remind ourselves of that story, kind of as John tells it. So in the beginning, this is where a lot of what Scott said comes in. We were made to bear God's image. Like mirrors, we were designed to reflect the love, the life, the light of God into the world. That's what we're for. This is our calling. As Tom Wright puts it, this is the human vocation. It's what humans are for. And it's true worship. So worship is much more than singing. But rather than trusting the purpose that God had given us, humanity was deceived. A serpent, we probably know the story, twisted the truth, and Adam and Eve reached for the one thing God had said not to take: the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And in doing that, they turned their backs on the tree of life. And then sin enters the world. And this is really important because we often reduce sin to rule breaking. But it's actually much more than that. It's bigger than that. Because sin distorts what we were meant to be. We're meant to be mirrors that reflect the love of God. And instead, it bends us inward. It corrupts our worship, which should bring love and life. And so we were made to reflect God, but sin shatters the mirror. And at its root, the power of sin comes from our worship. So we give our hearts to things that are not God, to money, power, sex, success, dopamine, any manner of things, none of them necessarily evil in and of their own right. But worship means that we choose to give them a priority they shouldn't have. And in doing that, they become powers that can warp us out of shape. I'm just going to take a quick example. If you take money, which I think is the easiest one to see, held rightly, it's an amazing tool. But when you worship it, it can become a tyrant. Greed grows. We can become blind to the fact that our need for more money is hurting ourselves, begins to rob us of joy, but then it can begin to impact others as well. And when enough people start living like that, it can become oppressive. And that's how ordinary things, which shouldn't have power, become real powers that are able to enslave us because we give them that power through our worship. And in doing that, we become less human and the world suffers for it. That's essentially what God told Adam and Eve after they ate, that the world would be marked by a curse, by death and darkness and thorns. And John shows us, and the reason John so leans on this Genesis imagery is because John is showing us that Jesus is coming into the world to undo it. So he puts the story of Eden front and center in the way he tells the crucifixion. You know, it starts in a garden. Jesus is crucified near a garden. He's buried in a garden. The crown of thorns reminds us of the crown of the curse. Adam and Eve become aware of their nakedness. Jesus is stripped naked by us. And the list goes on. And so John's showing us that Jesus is undoing what happened in the garden. And we've seen it all the way through the gospel. Every week of this teaching series has been an example of Jesus putting things right, of Jesus being the tree of life that we had turned away from all that time ago. And he calls out the power of sin when he sees it, whether that's in empire or religion or any other context. And Jesus lives out what we've called earlier the human vocation. He lives it out perfectly. So he is the light in the darkness. He is the love that casts out all fear. He is life where before there was only death. But of course, what we've seen is going around and putting everything right puts him in conflict with these very systems, with the very people that want things to stay wrong because it suits them very nicely. And so John shows us this tension rising everywhere he goes, healing sick, forgiving sins, welcoming the untouchable, casting out demons. Where he goes, the powers of darkness start to lose their grip. And so it has to stop. In a world ruled by darkness, the darkness must put the light out. I think that's how John presents it. So all these different powers, you've got them political, religious, spiritual, very much in the frame. They all come together to try and kill him. So the first time round in Eden, the serpent tricked mankind into eating the fruit. We spoke about that a moment ago. The fruit of the cursed tree, and that led to estrangement from God. But this time round, mankind nails God to the cursed tree. So it flips the story and makes it even more awful. But this means that the tree of life, that's Jesus, covers the tree of knowledge, good and evil, with his blood. And he's stripped naked like Adam. He's crowned with the curse, with those thorns. He's mocked. And the powers at this point in the story think that they have won. And again, John is telling us that this is the moment of God's glory. So is this the moment of God's glory? It's hard to see. But yes, yes, it is. Because in Jesus, God has entered into our brokenness. He's taken on that curse. He's faced the power of sin head on. And on the cross, we see who our God really is. God's finally been unmasked. And what we see is that God is love. He's the God who came to us no matter what the cost was to himself. He's the God who stops at nothing. He is the God of glory. But he's also the God that we put to death. And so we ourselves have been unmasked as well. And it shows us how incredibly broken we are apart from God. And all these powers we've spoken about of rule and religion and death, they have been unmasked as well. And they've been defeated. And so back to my question, how is this the moment of Jesus's and of God's greatest glory? If, as I said earlier, crucifixion's designed to say that you are nothing, Jesus redefines glory. And he shows us that glory is not found in power, money, or strength, but in becoming nothing for the sake of others. And so on the cross, Jesus faced every dark power that there is in this world. And we know from living in this world that there are many, not just sin, but death, shame, accusation, violence, and all kinds of different oppression. And he didn't defeat them by fighting back, although he could have. We see time and time again in the Gospels, people would have loved to join him in that way. Instead, he let these powers do their worst, run their course, take out all their hatred and anger on him. And he died. But then 3 days later, he went through death. And he came out the other side of death into a new kind of life so that they had been overcome by love. And that is the passage on there. As strong as death is love, nestled away in the Song of Solomon. I think it's one of the most profound and important little verses in scripture that we don't talk about very often. We'll talk about some of this a bit more next week as we look at the resurrection, go into more detail on what that really means for us. But as we get towards the end, I just want to ask you to turn your eyes here to our cross in the corner of the room and to try and see Golgotha through John's eyes. 6 o'clock now. The sun's setting. It's casting long shadows over the disused quarry. The crowds have thinned. The soldiers packing up, but John is still there. He's watching, remembering. He's with the man that he loved more than any other. And we have this idea that Jesus was on a very tall cross, on a very tall hill. But you can probably forget that. It's more likely that he was only a few feet off the ground, little more than eye level. And so John watches close up, not from far away, as Jesus gathers the last of his strength and he calls out, "It is finished." John doesn't know it yet. This is what he spends a lifetime mulling over. But sin's power has been broken. Its price has been paid. The old order is gone. The new creation has come. And this is what glory looks like. Jesus' body is then laid in a garden tomb. But that particular talk's next week's. And so my question for you as we look at the cross for us to all think about is, where is your worship? We sang earlier, every idol fell down. I think that's been the theme of this particular talk. Where is your worship? Because Jesus is the only one who deserves it. So think, we've spoken about all these kinds of powers. Where do they still hold sway in your life? I'd encourage you to bring them to the foot of the cross, because Jesus has already defeated them for us. We're going to finish now with a brief moment of pause. But I'd encourage you at some point during the worship, if you'd like to come and stand near the cross, as John would have done, rather than kneel, to stand and look on Jesus. And before we pause, I just want to say that Jesus, for my part, I hope on behalf of others in the room, I thank you for the cross. I thank you for what you did for us. I thank you for what you went through. I thank you for what you won for us. I thank you for what it means for us now in our day-to-day lives. And with that, let's just pause for a moment.